structural, we'll see fibrous and structural are pretty much the same type of protein. So starting out with globular protein, that is a type of protein that is particularly important because enzymes are globular proteins. We're going to end up talking a lot about globular proteins. They tend to be very soluble, freely soluble proteins, so they're very charged. They have lots of hydrophilic residues on their surface. They have a core area where all the hydrophobic residues hide, kind of excluding water. Again, enzymes are globular. Besides the hydrophobic effect, which remember is the primary way that proteins maintain their tertiary structure, is via the hydrophobic effect, meaning just like attract like, hydrophilic things tend to gather towards the outside, be near water, hydrophobic things towards the center. The other two ways that proteins, particularly globular proteins, maintain tertiary structure is they form salt bridges. And notice that's really an ionic bond between an acid and a base. And they form disulfide bonds, disulfide bridges. And notice that is a bridge between those two active sulfur groups in cysteine residues. And disulfide bridges form very, very easily. Remember, those sulfurs are highly reactive, lots of electron density there. And if they get anywhere near each other, they easily form disulfide bridges. The feature that globular proteins share that's important is they have a site that we call the active site where they can bind a small molecule or a substrate. We call that small molecule substrate. So all globular proteins have some sort of site where they can bind a small molecule or substrate. So introduction to enzymes, which we're going to come back and talk about immediately after Twitter. Again, an enzyme is a biological catalyst, so it converts some kind of reactant or substrate to product. It's a globular protein. An enzyme often requires an extra or supplementary group for it to be active. And the supplementary group that it requires is called a cofactor. So enzymes, most of them require cofactors to be fully active. And there's two types of cofactors, organic and inorganic. Inorganic is the simplest. They tend to be metals like iron, copper, and magnesium. So that the enzyme requires iron, copper, and magnesium to be fully active. Or they can be organic, and there's two types of organic cofactors. One is a coenzyme, which comes and goes, easily removed. It's usually a vitamin. We're going to see lots of vitamins that act as coenzymes or organic cofactors. And the other type of organic cofactor is called a prosthetic group. And a prosthetic group is something that's covalently attached to the enzyme. They cannot come and go. And the big example of that we're going to see is the heme group in hemoglobin and myoglobin. Many globular proteins are glycoproteins. And glycoproteins are basically globular proteins that are in circulation that have been modified by putting a sugar on them. So glycosylation is attachment of a sugar unit to a protein, making a glycoprotein. What this does is you can look at the sugar unit, and you remember the sugar unit's got lots of hydroxyl groups on it, so it increases greatly the hydrophilicity, solubility of the protein. It also enhances biological activity of the protein, and the way it does that is, you remember we have a variety of different sugars. There's lots and lots of sugars in the body. And each of those sugars has lots of hydroxyl groups on it, and it can basically attach to the protein with any of those hydroxyl groups. So you've got lots of sugars, lots of hydroxyl groups. So the possibilities of different sugar modifications are pretty much exponential. And what that means is that glycoproteins, these proteins with sugars attached, have what we call very high information content. And information content is important because it is through these sugars that are attached to these proteins that cells communicate with each other and that they recognize each other. So they recognize something as being foreign or as being self, which has to do with your immune system, and also the way they communicate with each other. So glycosylation is a very important part of making a protein fully functional or modifying a protein once it is synthesized. And again, it's putting a sugar group on it. There's two types of glycosylation. The enzymatic type is the easiest because it's very specific. It's enzyme directed, so there's a specific enzyme telling the sugar what protein to go to. Generally involves some kind of anhydride formation, enzymatic glycosylation. The other type of glycosylation is not at all specific. There's no enzyme involved. It's called non-enzymatic glycosylation. And it involves formation of a shift base. And hopefully you've heard of a shift base in organic chemistry. And basically, a shift base, you can see, is when the sugar, the aldehyde group, for instance, the glucose, attaches itself to the amino group on the protein. That could be one of the side chain groups for, say, lysine that's sticking off the protein. And the aldehyde group reacts with the amino group, and you get a shift base. Notice that is a reversible reaction, shift base formation. And again, the key about non-enzymatic glycosylation is it's not specific, so it can pretty much go on pretty much all over the place. And we're going to see more about non-enzymatic glycosylation in a little clinical correlate. The other type of protein, moving on from globular. So globular are important because enzymes are globular. Globular proteins can bind some sort of substrate at a site we call the active site. They can also be glycosylated, important again for information content, which allows cells to communicate with each other and recognize each other. Another type of protein that's really important, that is a membrane protein. We're going to see these again in some detail when we talk about membrane. For now, you can see a picture of a variety of different membrane proteins. Many of the membrane proteins have a globular domain on them, so part of them is globular in nature, meaning it can bind the substrate. Membrane proteins, of course, are associated or anchored somehow to a membrane. That's why we call them membrane proteins. And they fall into three basic categories. Membrane proteins can be receptors. So that would be a membrane protein that's stuck in, through, or sitting on a membrane, which has a globular piece to it where it can bind something. It can act as a receptor for things like hormones. They can be transporters, so they can span the membrane. You can see some examples up there of some of those white blobs that are going all the way through the membrane, so they can transport things in and out. And some of the proteins, particularly the ones that sit on the outside, and they're almost always glycoproteins, are responsible for cell-cell recognition and communication. And those are the proteins you see sitting on the outside of the membrane. And they're glyco, i.e. they have carbohydrates attached to them. So these little sticks are the carbohydrate chains, sugars attached to the protein. And remember, that gives it very high information content and allows cell-cell communication and recognition. So we're going to come back and see these. Again, you can see some of them span, and that allows transport of molecules in and out. Some of them sit on the inside, some on the outside. So we're going to come back and look in detail at these membrane proteins. We'll talk about membranes on Monday. The receptors then would have a piece sitting on the outside that's globular in nature. Transporter goes through. Cell-cell recognition is glycosylated, has those sugars sitting off of it. And when we talk about membranes on Monday, we'll look at blood typing, how we can use some of those carbohydrates, particularly the enzymes, the direct enzyme-specific glycosylation, to figure out what blood types people are. That's the ABO system of blood typing. Again, membranes, which we're going to focus on Monday, remember when we talk about them that they have a place, and that is that they are basically the walls of cells, both the compartments inside cells and cells themselves. So these are basically the outside structure of cells. So their permeability, a barrier, that allows only certain things in and certain things out. So you can kind of keep in a big picture what membranes are not kind of just floating around, but they are actually parts of cells. And we're going to see, again on Monday, some detail about that. Now, fibrous proteins, which include structural proteins, the collagens and elastins, which we're going to talk about, are very different than globular proteins or membrane proteins. And the main difference is they're very tough. They're structural components of the body. They're very insoluble to the framework, the connective tissues, the muscles. They have a really different kind of feel to them. They're tough, kind of stringy, fibrous. Again, collagen, which we're going to see in a few minutes, will be one of the ones we talk about. The other thing about fibrous and structural proteins that we're going to see is that they all have a single secondary structural pattern. So they're unique in that way, meaning that a fibrous protein may be all alpha helix, or all beta sheet, or all some sort of secondary structural repeating pattern. And that's what kind of gives them that toughness, is that their secondary structural elements don't differ. So they don't have alpha helix that then breaks off into beta sheet, beta turns, and some undescribed areas. They don't have that. They're very regular repeating units of secondary type structure. And we're going to see a couple of examples of that. And that's what gives them, again, that insolubility or that connective tissue-ness about them. So again, talking about non-enzymatic glycosylation, to do that we need to say a word about insulin. Something we'll go into detail after next month. But very briefly,
question.
Did you say that fibrous proteins are usually not included in membranes?
No, yeah, they're different. The globular membrane fibers, different types of proteins. Which has to do with non-enzymatic glycosylation. We need a really big picture of what happens in the body when we eat. Basically, we eat, we call the fed state. Our blood glucose goes up relatively rapidly. And the pancreas responds to this by releasing a hormone called insulin. And the insulin is what allows us to use the blood glucose, and in this using, transporting, using it, storing it, making things, using it, bring blood glucose levels back down to the normal level. That's how a kind of a normal individual functions. Of course, somebody who's diabetic, which some of you may be yourselves or know people who are, they either don't have any insulin or they have insulin and they're insensitive to it. Somehow it doesn't work anymore, their body doesn't respond to it. And so basically when they eat, the insulin's not there to direct the use of glucose and lower the blood sugar. So their blood sugar levels reach high levels and can stay at high levels for extended periods of time. Now what happens is, you remember when we look back at our glycosylation, we have glucose, three aldehyde groups, and we've got lots of proteins around, of course, made of lots of proteins in our body. So glucose molecules around for long periods of time will react with the free amines on circulating proteins. So if you've got high glucose levels for long periods of time, those free aldehyde groups are going to react with free amine groups in all of your circulating proteins. Well, one of the circulating proteins that happens to be the most abundant and so is affected by this the most is hemoglobin. Hemoglobin. So you've got lots and lots of hemoglobin. What we're going to talk about is how we transport oxygen from our lungs to our tissues to oxygenate them. Hemoglobin, lots of it. It's a good protein. But what happens in diabetics who have elevated glucose levels over a period of time is their hemoglobin becomes non-enzymatically glycosylated. Now in the short term, that is a reversible thing. So you know, as we look at our picture there, you can see that that reaction is reversible. But what happens over longer periods of time, if blood glucose levels are not maintained, is we can go on from that nice shift base and actually form a covalent bond, cross-linking covalent bonds. And what that is called, hemoglobin, if we looked in our plasma and took out some of the hemoglobin, and we saw that there was covalent bonds to glucose, cross-linking different proteins to glucose, we would call that advanced glycosylation end products, or ages. And so by looking at the number of ages in the plasma, how much of the hemoglobin is permanently glycosylated, we can get some kind of indicator of long-term blood glucose control, which for most of us, of course, is not a problem because we have insulin which takes care of that for us. And clearly, if you're a diabetic and you have to provide yourself with your own insulin, it requires that you be very diligent in knowing what your blood glucose levels are and knowing when you need to add insulin to your system, when you need to add sugar to your system. And it's a very rigorous thing, and you have to be very dedicated in order to avoid, of course, the side effects that come from having diabetes, particularly over a number of years. So this is particularly important for those with juvenile diabetes, which is usually seen in children or young adults. And that's when the pancreas, they don't have any insulin. The beta cells do not produce insulin. So they have to do that themselves all their lives. Well, the more in control they stay of that, the longer their life expectancy is going to be, the less problems they're going to have. Circulatory, you know, there's lots of side effects with diabetes. People get gangrene, that's basically a circulatory problem. They have eye problems, again, circulatory problems, blindness, kidney problems. Lots of things can develop. But the better they do at this long-term maintenance, then the better off they will be. So the clinician can use this as one of the ways of kind of sneaking in and telling when the patient comes to see them and says, oh yes, I do, you know, do this regularly and I take good care of myself and I'm following exactly this routine, they can kind of look at these advanced glycosylation inputs to get an idea for themselves how well the person's doing at maintaining good or normal blood plasma glucose levels. So that's one way that glycosylation can actually be used clinically to do something. So again, if glucose levels are high just for a short period of time, glucose comes in contact with lots of hemoglobin, it does form some shift-based bonds. We don't panic about it, it's okay because most of them are reversible. At any time, there will be a little bit of glycosylated hemoglobin, there's normal levels. And again, if your blood glucose levels stay high over long periods of time, so there's lots of glucose being in contact with lots of hemoglobin, it'll go on beyond that, and you'll get covalent bonds being formed. And then you'll get an actual entity that we can actually measure, which is an advanced glycosylation end product, or an age, AGE. But again, remember, that's a clinical correlate. But the key thing about glycosylation is high information content. Lots of variety allows cell-cell communication and cell-cell recognition. That's why it's an important concept. Fibrous proteins are structural proteins. And the main structural protein is collagen, and that's what we're going to talk about. Almost 25% of the protein in your body, or that protein that, remember, is being stored genetically as DNA, being passed to the messenger RNA, we get translation, we get the protein made. Almost 25% of all that that's going on is to make collagens, different types of collagen. So a lot of your body protein is collagen. It is, of course, a structural element of your connective tissues, and it's got some really unique functionality about it, and there's a lot known about it. First of all, its amino acid sequence is very, very unusual and very interesting, and that is that it has a glycine every third residue. So if we take a piece of collagen and we denature it, stretch it out, and sequence it, we'll find a glycine every third residue. Because glycine, you remember, that's our R group, is just the H, so it's very tiny, just a very little R group. It's so little, collagen forms a helix, a type of alpha helix that's special from a normal alpha helix, because it has only 3.0 residues per turn rather than 3.6, so it's tight. It forms a nice, tight, coily little helix. Three of those collagen helices will then come together and make kind of a braid, if you can picture that. And that's called a triple helix. So three collagen helices kind of braid themselves together and make a triple helix. And then the triple helix kind of stagger themselves in a certain fashion and form covalent cross-links, which make what's called a fibril. And that's basically the connective tissue, that tough thing that becomes collagen. So basically what this is a summary of primary, secondary, tertiary, structure. So the amino acid sequence, unique, glycine every third position is the primary structure. The particularly tight collagen helix is its secondary structure. Its tertiary structure is a triple helix, and basically it has quaternary structure in that all of these triple helices kind of align together to make a fibril of collagen. There are some specializations in collagen that allow all of these things to occur. And one of the things that specializes in collagen and also very strange is that proline is very abundant. And the reason that's strange and that comes to mind is because on the homework, and as we said, when we talked about secondary structure, proline is usually a helix breaker. You remember it's that amino acid that does not have any free rotation about the alpha carbon, stuck in a ring shape. So it can't really twist itself into an alpha helix, yet it does in this case. So proline is very abundant. A lot of the prolines are hydroxylated, so there's lots of hydroxy groups on the prolines in collagen. There is a specific enzyme which does this hydroxylation, and so we're going to see our first couple of enzymes here. And the enzyme is called prolyl hydroxylase. Notice the hydroxylase. The ending of that name is A-S-E. Pretty much every enzyme we will see ends in A-S-E. So if you see a name like prolyl hydroxylase, you don't know what it is, it ends in A-S-E, it's probably an enzyme. The name usually also tells us what's going on. In other words, proline, hydroxylase, hydroxylation. So we're putting a hydroxyl group on proline. So we're going to find, luckily, because we're going to start covering a lot of enzymes, that the name makes sense. And again, we're looking for that A-S-E ending. Notice this enzyme, which remember is a globular protein. So it's got an active site. It can bind a substrate. So it binds the prolines on collagen and hydroxylates them. And it requires a cofactor to be fully active. And the cofactor this time is vitamin C, or ascorbic acid, and so that would be an organic cofactor, which is a coenzyme, a vitamin. Another thing that, another amino acid besides glycine, obviously because it occurs in every third position, that is abundant in collagen is lysine. And a lot of the lysine is also hydroxylated. Another enzyme, lysyl hydroxylase. Again, the name tells us what it's doing. A-S-E tells us it's an enzyme. Got a cofactor, which is also an organic coenzyme, vitamin C. Vitamin C. The hydroxylysine, some of them are glycosylated. So some of the hydroxylysine is glycosylated, has sugar groups attached to it. So it adds functionality to the collagen. At the end of the collagen helices, which remember, called collagen helices because they're particularly tight, 3.0 residues per turn rather than 3.6. At the end of them, there's always a cysteine, which forms a disulfide bridge when these collagen helices break themselves into a triple helix. So what happens is three collagen helices come together, braid themselves, and then they make sure they stay that way by forming disulfide bonds, which are, they're able to do because of these cysteines that are at the end of the collagen helices. Now, what happens for fibril formation? Basically, there's covalent cross-linking that goes on. For covalent cross-linking to occur, we basically are going to need some kind of carbonyl functionality, like an aldehyde group, and three amino groups, kind of like we saw in glycosylation, and then go to the next step where it forms a covalent cross-link. A lot of the aldehyde groups that are involved in the cross-linking come from oxidation of some of the lysine and hydroxylysines. So basically what happens is that free amine group on lysine and hydroxylysine can become an aldehyde. So the amine is converted into an aldehyde, and it's called allysine. Allysine. Again, there's an enzyme. So this is the third one we've seen. It's called lysyl oxidase. Again, oxidase tells you what's happened. The oxidation is happening to lysine. Again, the ASE ending. You'll notice lysyl oxidase has two cofactors, copper, which is an inorganic cofactor, and vitamin B6, which is an organic coenzyme. So copper and vitamin B6 are cofactors. You need both of those to be fully active. That's lysyl oxidase. Now, reaction between these aldehydes that we've just made and three amino groups, which tend to come from other lysine residues, form a shift base, and then finally, the covalent cross-link. Covalent cross-link. So we've got three enzymes here, which we've introduced in collagen synthesis and collagen production. Prolyl hydroxylase, lysyl hydroxylase, both of which hydroxylate proline and lysine respectively. Both have cofactors vitamin C. And then the last enzyme, lysyl oxidase, which oxidizes the free amine group on lysine, some of the hydroxylysine. And that particular enzyme requires two cofactors, one inorganic and one organic. So the inorganic one, copper, and the organic one is vitamin B6. So many vitamins that we take on a daily basis function as cofactors for enzymes. All of this stuff in the maturation, and this picture looks very familiar, hopefully, from protein synthesis and maturation, is of course occurring in a certain place in the cell. And so it's kind of like a concrete example of what we talk about in general in protein maturation and synthesis. Of course, in the nucleus, the genetic information is being stored. We have transcription passing from DNA through messenger RNA, translation, remember involving the ribosomes and the tRNAs. Finally, we get collagen synthesized on the surface of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. It's now inside the ER. Inside the ER is a lot of processing going on. We said a lot of different things can happen to proteins in there. We know that in collagen, some of the proline, some of the lysine is hydroxylated. Some of the lysines are glycosylated, adding sugars to them. The disulfide bonds form between the collagen helices. That's to hold the triple helix in its shape. And so that's, of course, the folding of the triple helix. Then at that point, it can be excreted, secreted from the cell, and the rest occurs extracellularly, the rest of the processing and the formation of the fibrils. So that means the lysine, hydroxylysine, that enzyme is extracellular. We get allysine, we get shift base formation, and then finally we end up with the cross-linking that leaves us with these tough strands or fibrils, which we call collagen. So this is just a picture of the processing, which we talked about in words. And again, it lends a concrete example, sort of, to what we talked about when we talked about protein synthesis and maturation. So this is an example of an actual protein and how it goes through transcription, translation, processing, excretion, more processing sometimes occurs extracellularly, and then it's finally a fully active protein. So collagen, we talk about it in some detail because it's so abundant. So again, about 25% of our proteins that are going through this whole process come out of collagen. Elastin is another one that is a fibrous or structural protein. that is fairly abundant. It lacks the genetic complexities, the processing that's needed, and it lacks the helical structure of collagen. Elastin and collagen share a couple of things in common. One is the prolines in elastin are also hydroxylated. Notice, though, that lysine is not hydroxylated in elastin, so you get no glycosylation. It's much simpler, doesn't carry the inflammation content that collagens do. Some lysines in elastin are oxidized to allysine or active aldehydes, so those are features that it shares in common. You will notice this structure that you see here is called desmosine. That thing that says four-way cross-linked with strands sticking off of it. And it should say, instead of strand two at the top, it should say 1, 2, 3, 4. So it's got four strands sticking off of a little cross-link. That whole thing right there is called desmosine. And so what elastin is basically a polymer of desmosines. So these desmosines form and then they come together as polymers and form elastin. And what it is, again, is an example of how structural and fibrous proteins have only one type of secondary structural element or motif, and it repeats itself. So basically, collagen just has collagen helices. Of course, they braid themselves into a triple helix and then form fibrils, but secondarily, it's all made of collagen helices. Elastin is all made of these desmosine molecules, which again link themselves together into a polymer to make elastin. So collagen and elastin, two important structural fibrous proteins. The other ones that you know about particularly are keratins, skin, hair, nails. There's two types of keratins, alpha and beta. Alpha keratins are made pretty much entirely of alpha helix. Beta keratins are made entirely of beta sheets. Again, emphasizing, since they're structural or fibrous proteins, they have just that one repeating secondary motif. Alpha keratin is alpha helix, beta keratin is beta sheet. In hair and nails, the alpha helices are basically kind of tied together, if you will, or cross-linked by disulfide bridges. The alpha keratin or the alpha helices in nails have lots and lots of disulfide bridges so that they're attached really tightly together, and that's what gives your nails that hardness that you feel and resistance to chemical alteration. What that means translated is you can paint them with nail polish, you can stick them in, even pretty strong acid, you can get acid on your hand, and your nail just doesn't dissolve, disappear. So you can dip your hands in things and obviously your nails stay there. Not that easy to destroy a nail. So it's hard, it's chemically resistant. Hair, however, the alpha keratins in hair had relatively few disulfide bonds, not many at all. And so we can take hair and actually put some chemicals on it and cause the disulfide bonds to break. We can reduce them with a reducing agent. And then you can tangle the hair into whatever kind of pattern you want. In other words, put curlers in it and then throw another chemical on it, reoxidizes the disulfide bond, and that's what you call a permanent wave. So you can play with hair and make it get curly. And the way you're doing that is you are actually changing the structure of the alpha keratins in your hair. And it smells bad, but basically the reducing agent and the oxidizing agent don't smell good that they put on it. Of course, you will notice when you get a permanent wave, your hair goes back to its genetic predisposition. So as it's growing out, if you really are a person with very straight hair, that DNA for straight hair is going to keep being passed along, and as you form new proteins, new keratins, you're going to come back out with straight hair. If you grow out again and change it, you're going to keep having whatever was genetically predisposition. There's a lot of diseases related to collagen and problems with collagen, particularly at genetic levels. I listed three of them here. You don't need to memorize these, just kind of for your own information. Osteogenesis imperfecta. I saw a program on television just this last week about that. It's people with abnormal bone fragility. They really cannot live deep functional lives because their bones break so very easily, just falling down, tapping themselves on something, their bones break. That's all from abnormalities in gene coding for collagen. Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, they have a lot of skin abnormalities and are often people we call double jointed or hypermobile joints. Again, abnormalities in collagen. And there's another disease, Menkes disease, which causes growth retardation. And again, that is actually a lipoxidase deficiency. And what's interesting about that is, remember, lipoxidase is the enzyme that oxidizes some of the active amines on lysine, the active aldehyde group. And you remember that it needed copper and vitamin B6 to be fully functional. So if you have any kind of copper metabolism abnormalities, any enzyme that needs copper as a coenzyme will not be fully functional. So kind of interesting. Again, an introduction to enzymes. So that's pretty much the material there.